Ladies and gentlemen, it's spoiler in time, where we spoil shows we've been watching. Cord Killers is our other show where we talk about how to watch things, how to use the technology to get to watch the shows. And then after we've watched them, we come here and we spoil them. Today, we're going to spoil Justified, episode 6 of season 5, the movie Split, and the rest of the episodes of The Young Pope from 106 to 110. I'm Tom Merritt, Brian Brushwood.
Hey, man. Yeah, not only are we going to do all of that, well, we should, but I feel like we're going to take just a quick moment to let people know that we did intend to go week by week on The Expanse. This week I slipped, so instead we're going to have a special triage segment after we talk about the movie draft! Tom?
Brian, I'm putting on a hat.
Yeah, okay.
So that I may take my hat off to you.
Oh, may I take my hat off and put
to
it
yourself.
Right back
you
on because
it.
I'm the winner!
There's pretty much no mathematical way you could not be the winner at this point. 727 million to DTNS's 708 million, DTNS being me, and you have the last movie. Although Team DTNS has one more movie in the bank coming out this week. Unfortunately, it's Collide. And you have Logan.
Is that up against Logan, same day?
No, Logan's 2 weeks away.
Consecutive weeks.
Logan's 2 weeks away?
I mean, you don't even need it.
Okay, I know, but still, like, you saw Logan.
I did.
Can you not tell me anything about it and just kind of, you know, allude to how it made you feel? Did you ever play the game The Last of Us? Was it like the game The Last of Us? Because I looked at it.
I did not play The Last of Us, so I cannot comment. I cannot approve or deny whether it is the movie version of The Last of Us, which a lot of people have said it should be.
Oh, man. I am so excited. By the way, real quick, Rotten Tomatoes on Logan, 99% and 97% on Rotten Tomatoes. I've gotten spontaneous tweets from friends just screaming with giddiness that it's like, this is happening. Like this is... it says here 95% positive reviews. It slipped. 99%
I should disclose
want
that my wife
see.
Works for Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay. Oh. We have a new game and a new mug.
We need to make a new
incoming.
Mug.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So you saw it. What? Just tell me. No content.
And no spoilers.
No spoilers.
I'm not going to make another title.
What did it feel like going in? And what was your journey like
oh yeah, so like seeing the trailer, I thought it's probably going to be a pretty good movie. It looks pretty serious. I'm intrigued with the idea of old Logan or old Logan, as I would call him, and I was put in a positive mind. I had good expectations, so I wasn't going in with low expectations. I thought it was going to be good. What I got just made me cheer, and I loved it.
That's so great. Okay, great. Like emotionally, yeah. Like, okay, I don't want you to compare apples and oranges, but like better than the Avengers.
That's definitely an apple and orange comparison, right?
Yeah.
So you know, some people just like oranges better. Some people like apples.
Same
right?
Ballpark though.
Right. But sometimes you're like, I need my thirst quenched. I want an orange, or I need a little more satisfaction in my diet. I need an apple. Logan is an apple.
Ooh, so good. Very, very excited. All right. So meanwhile, Tom, I'm afraid I'm going to need you to read our emails from triage because my computer just crashed.
Okay, fine. So we're going to move into our feedback situation here. And remember that Brian had asked you for your experiences watching The Expanse, especially if you weren't someone who had read the books before. And Tony wrote in and said, I, like Brian, am enjoying The Expanse television show as someone who never read the books. This is also the case with Game of Thrones. I think I was able to follow Game of Thrones a little easier. Actually, with The Expanse, I really struggled to remember what happened in the first season, even though I liked it very much. It's slowly coming back, and listening to Spoilering Time is actually helping to jog my memory. I did remember the Mormon ship when they brought it up again, though. I love the realistic treatment of space travel and combat. Characters are mostly interesting. However, the Martian Marines seem way over the top to me.
Agreed.
I forget the main Marine character's name, even though you mention her by name in the show. I just listened to 5 minutes ago.
Agreed.
So,
I don't remember her name either.
It's Bobby Draper.
She's and I'm sure we'll all fall in love with her. And it sounds like it was brilliant casting, and it sounds like it's going to be great. But that's just from the buzz around it.
And then Ryan said, I wanted to give my thoughts on The Expanse. I've not read the books, but I'm loving the show. In the last episode, Brian mentioned that Holden's reaction seemed out of place. I disagree. To me, it felt very much in character. However, I do feel that I have an advantage in that I did binge the entire first season 2 weeks before the premiere of the second season. So the characters' motivations are more fresh in my mind than if someone hadn't watched any since last season. Having seen episode 4, however, I don't think that the reaction from Holden was meant to play a big part in episode 3, but was setting up events for episode 4.
Yeah, well, I'll find out when I watch it and get caught up, and we talk about it next week, and you're 100% right. I think that I suspect the expanse of the show is a show that will derive a outsized benefit from being binged straight through while everything's fresh in your mind. I think it'll be really, really, really good.
All right, let's move on to the young Pope. Now, Brian, admittedly, you still have a few more minutes left in the finale, right?
Yeah, but you could spoil me at this point, because to be honest, like, I felt a heart swell in, like, I felt I spent most, okay, so I spent the first 3 episodes thinking it was a house of cards, and the middle 3 episodes feeling a little bit confused why it wasn't more House of Cards. It felt a little bit Monster of the Week, X-Files. And then the last 3 episodes, realizing as they lengthened the time span and we saw characters and storylines get tied up in immensely satisfying and surprising ways, I realized that it is a meditation on a genuine person who is trying to become Pope and doesn't necessarily know what he's doing. And when he prays, it's not Machiavellian. And when he's having a crisis of faith, it's not that he's been, pulling the strings the entire time. It's that he's just having a crisis of faith. And seeing episodes 8 and 9, watching, his spiritual father die and seeing him break and lose it, seeing him troubled by the almost love interest in the early episodes and really, really troubled by the fact that they took everything from the place except for the picture of him and the baby with all that awkwardness. It just all felt so, so human. And episode 9 was the one where he sent the incompetent alcoholic to investigate.
And Jude Law is barely in the episode. It's all in New York.
And instead, you see him succeed beyond all doubts. And the best part is you're left with the impression that he never meant him to fail, that he just felt like it was right to send him. And it turns out he's right. That leads you to think, well, maybe he is the divinely inspired choice for the hand of God.
Lenny's justification, which I think maybe is in episode 3 or episode 10, is that he knew that the priest that he sent was molested as a child. And he knew
so he would have you're insights.
Going, yeah, right, right. Like you're going to make sure that the right thing happens to this guy.
Well,
and he compliments him by saying you turned your fear into anger. Like he did it as much to help Gutierrez confront his fears as he did to actually prosecute the case.
Mm-hmm. I gotta tell you, I thought I loved it for one thing at the beginning, and I thought I was going to enjoy that weird, I guess we'll call it salacious feeling the entire way through. But instead, I just adored it for being exactly what it was. For example, I thought during the water episode that it's like, oh, this chick gonna get her comeuppance.
The episode in Africa?
Yeah. Like I thought that was a straight up monster of the week. He's gonna use his Pope powers to strike her down. And instead, he was politic and navigated very human nuances, mm-hmm. and gave a largely, inspiring message, despite the fact that it's really kind of a messed up situation with the way that chick's running things. Mm-hmm. It felt, I don't know, there's a sweetness and an authenticity that I did mm-hmm. not expect. Now, maybe the last 30 minutes of episode 10 undercuts all that, but I want to hear about it.
Well, okay, but also going back to the Africa thing, he then does exactly that and divinely kills this woman.
Okay.
Well, he stops in the rest stop in Italy and prays, and then she is killed
at that exact time from
Well, which they sort of imply. Well, they don't imply. It just seems so coincidental that you wonder if something got left and it's very clearly choking on the water or stuff.
Well, I think that's what I love about this is they started. I'm all for a period piece type of thing, and this is not a period piece in that it's in the past, but I love this idea of like, here's what it's like inside the Vatican, right? And I'm like, I'm fascinated, I'm in. You can do whatever. I'm just having a good time taking a tour of the Vatican and seeing behind the scenes. Then they say, well, let's throw a little Dan Brown. Let's pretend there's a conspiracy. Let's have the Secretary of State have some machinations. And you think, oh, okay, so I'm going to get a little Dan Brown conspiratorial thing in here. Then they have the Pope say, I don't believe in God. And you're like, oh, okay, I know what this is going to be. This is going to be the fraud that is religion. It's going to attack religion, and it's going to show that religion doesn't have any real basis, and it's all built on a house of cards. But then you find out him saying he doesn't believe in God actually doesn't mean he doesn't have faith. So it's a much more nuanced thing. And then you think, well, wait a minute, is this going to become a peon to religion? And the fact that none of us really believe, but if we have faith, then we can perform miracles. It doesn't do any of those. In the end, what I love about this series is it says we're trying very hard to show what human people do when they decide to join a religion, why they decide to join a religion, how they actually think about when they are in one of the most powerful religions in the world, and how they are still just humans. And these things that you as a viewer, just like in real life, can decide, was that a miracle? A coincidence, or is there a scientific explanation for it, right? We as a show aren't going to dictate that to you. And the people within the Catholic Church in the show interpret it as a miracle the way they would in real life. And it's just so, it's not perfect, but it's so elegantly done in that way that it leaves it up to the viewer, but not in a way where you feel cheated.
Yeah, well, and that same theory, that Rorschach aspect of the show extends all the way to the characters themselves. Like at some point you kind of see the Prime Minister of the Vatican or whatever, the Secretary of State.
Yeah, yeah.
You see him come to grips over time with who this Pope is, and it's clear that there's no more struggle. It's clear that whatever their relationship is, they've moved beyond that phase.
Yeah.
And like that moment when they go to Africa and there's the standoff over the selfie pics and stuff, and he explains how it is and isn't going to be, and he's so politic and he's advocating on the behalf of the Pope. He's not trying to sabotage the Pope anymore. It just you see the same thing with Zefram Cochrane when he's dying. When he died, I totally cried.
Yeah, how's he gonna invent the warp drive now?
Yes, I mean, but hot damn! I love the fact that I don't know what to make of it, and I love the fact that yes, it's over the top. Yes, it takes itself so seriously. Mm-hmm. And yes, they got these long lingering shots of chicks with blood letters drawn on their naked boobs and whatever. All of that. Just let it be what it is and enjoy it for its own wacky self. Hot damn, have I loved it.
So should we talk very briefly about the end of episode 10? Because Brian doesn't know the entire second half of that episode.
I don't know. Is it worth saving?
Should we come back and do a footnote to this?
What I was going to say was I wonder if one of the reasons that it feels so human is the fact that they do these self-indulgent shots where you actually look at something and go, I don't really even know what this means, but it's sinking me into the universe more. And so when they do show people as human, it's not boring because you just, and they never do the same trick twice. You just showed me this really surreal thing, like the Pope crawling out of a mound of babies or actual protesters with the, you know, protest messages painted on their naked selves. And the last example of that, Bryce, and this is where I'm going with this, is at the very end of the episode 10, where he has decided to go to Venice to give his speech about the canonization of the saint. He is standing in the crowd, and as he's giving this speech about love, and everyone is smiling, and he's finally giving a positive message.
It's beautiful and gentle.
He basically finishes by saying, you know, God is smiling in much more eloquent words. We see two old hippies in the audience that very much are dressed the way we usually see his parents in flashbacks.
This is all through it like pans, a little telescope or through little binoculars.
Okay.
Right. That's right. The Pope Pius XIII is looking through a telescope that was given to him by Gutierrez, actually, as sort of a toy present of a type. He moves past. Then he goes back. And when he sees them, they are his young parents. And then it cuts away and cuts back and they're old again. Mm-hmm. And then they turn around and they start walking away.
Yeah.
And it's that combination of the surreal thing. Like how could he really have seen them? But also this, should you interpret it as it's just two people who kind of looked like his parents in the audience? Or was it actually his parents in the audience? Or is it totally in his imagination?
So normally when I use this phrase on just about anything, it's usually code for I think this thing is garbage. But I keep coming back to it, and I mean this in all sincerity as something wonderful. It is a series of meditations on the expectations and the reality of what it means for a human being to enter the politics,
the position of power,
the authority, the crisis of faith. It's a collection of short stories expressed in a pastiche of visual stuff. And I sound like I want to punch myself as I'm saying these things.
I mean, you're saying,
I mean all of these things, in a good way. Like, I adore it for what it is. And I'm so thrilled to hear there's going to be a second iteration of it.
So can I share my theory about what I think season two is going to be?
Sure, sure.
Yeah. Well, so, and real quickly, Brian, just so you know, after he sees the parents, he basically suffers a second attack and falls down. And we don't know how he is right at the end of this.
Second attack, his first being which one?
So the first, he's with Gutierrez, right, Bryce? When he has like the sort of like...
It's in the same episode.
Yeah, where he's like, it gets like lightheaded or dizzy. And,
Got it.
So he does that again. He walks off so that it kind of looks like the crowd can't see him. But like right under, you know, he's in front of this ledge, right under this ledge, he's like fallen back and... whether he's alive or not is in question.
Yeah, the Cardinals catch him and they all look worried.
So I think in season two, at the very end of this season, there's a lot of talk of, oh, you're a saint, you're doing miracles. And I feel like season two could focus on either he dies and we see him or the people around him try to reconcile what his after-death miracles will be, which are a part of sainthood, right? You have to do a certain amount of miracles.
Right, and they kind of prepped us with that with Juana and the canonization of her.
And so either there's some afterlife-y weird thing we see with him or not, but I think if he dies, I think that's an interesting angle that a season two could take.
Dude, you know what my theory is?
Sure.
He's in a coma for a half decade. What does the Vatican do? What does the Vatican do when... that he's not
when
dead
when he wakes up.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because it's a miracle
that he wakes up. Wow. Like there's all like, the politics play out while he's asleep and he wakes up.
You know what's interesting is that
now he's got to shake things up again.
So the very last shot is, you know, he's laid out on this where he's giving the address, and there's a zoom out, and it's like a Google Earth sort of zoom out from, then you see Venice and then Europe and then the globe, and then it says the young Pope, the end, which is weird because we know that there's going to be a second season.
Now he's going to be the old Pope. The old
Maybe
Pope
it's the
is
old
episode
pope
two.
Or the coma Pope. Like, there's the
or is there an even younger Pope?
The ghost Pope.
The ghost Pope. It could be. Or maybe the young saint. Like, we don't know. Because there's an interesting thing where, like, the way...
Oh, wait. What if he's declared, like, brain dead or whatever. So he is on the fast track to canonization.
Yeah. And he comes back.
And then he comes back.
From the dead.
For the world's first saint.
The young zombie.
I feel like that might be too far because they obviously have done this electric dance on a very
everything is plausible, right?
Correct. And then now we enter territory where it's like you lose all the Catholic audience and they're all like, well, I could see all this as a metaphor for what it must be like to take over the job as Pope or whatever, but now what is this supernatural stuff? I don't get it.
Oh, you missed, I think you missed by missing that last half, a really nice moment with Voiello and the Pope where they're on their way to Venice and they've stopped at a diner and they've like shut down half of this diner so he can eat in solace, and he's got his back to the crowd. And there's just this funny little moment that I love. It's all of these little stupid moments that I love about the show. And Voiello comes over and he puts down a can of the Cherry Coke Zero for the Pope while he's eating.
That's awesome. Okay, like where it's like, okay, all right, they get each other. They're the odd couple. It's fine. Yeah, dude. So many of those little vignettes are so great. Like when he's bored out of his mind and he's blessing the babies, he's like, "Oh, looks so much like you." And then, whoops. And then,
And then he's like, "No, but I still mean it." And he takes after you, just metaphorically, I guess, in this case.
Anyway, highly recommended for me. In fact, now that we're wrapping that up, if you guys want to chime in, hit us up at cordkillers@gmail.com. Tom.
Yes, Brian.
Tom.
We want to talk Split.
Did you watch the movie?
I did. I actually made myself run out and squeeze it in, and I thought I had the theater to myself. It was like one of those 4:40 p.m. showings, and I walked in like 10 minutes before the movie starts, and there's no one else in there. And I'm like, I'm gonna pretend I rented this theater out just for Cord Killers. Then like five more people showed up.
For the record, understand that I saw this movie in the context of a tweet from Jeff Cannata that said, I'm going to paraphrase here, but it basically said, "Hey, do yourself a favor and see Split, not knowing a single damn thing about it." I would like that. That is my gift to you. I think you would really like it. I'm Jeff Cannata. I don't watch trailers, which is really weird that he just mentioned that part of the end. And I went into it with that in mind. And so
In fact, I was playing it up so much that I refused to watch the Finding Dory cold open because it had the
word Split in there
in the headline.
And you didn't even want to know why the Split part wasn't relevant to the rest of it. And by the way, we're telling you this now because if you have not heard anything about Split, it's an M. Night Shyamalan movie. If you've ever enjoyed anything by M. Night Shyamalan, I highly recommend you stop right now. And I want to give you the same gift that Jeff gave to us. And now we're going to talk about opening up that gift.
So yesterday I was talking to my sister-in-law's husband and I said, "Have you seen Split?" He's like, "Man, I don't really like M. Night Shyamalan movies." I'm like, "Well, it's like his older movies." And he's like, "Well, what do you mean?" I'm like, "I don't know. Did you ever see Unbreakable?" And he's like, yeah, I liked that. I'm like, "So if you liked that, you should watch this." That is as close as I could get to making sure he would maybe see it without explaining why. And also checking, which unfortunately I didn't let anyone check with me on that. And I have not yet still seen Unbreakable.
Okay, yeah. And what I love about that moment is that like in order to recommend this movie properly, you need to learn how to act. Like you can't recommend the movie properly because what you want to say, the big spoiler is, holy shit, 13 years after the fact, they made a sequel to Unbreakable and didn't tell anyone that it's a sequel. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah.
So I watch this movie, and at the very end, I see Bruce Willis show up, and he answers the question, you know, "Mr. Glass," and I'm like, "Oh, okay, so this is alluding to something that I haven't seen, but this was a really good movie anyway." So I go home, and I call Brian, and Brian's like, "Well, how about that last scene?" And I was like, "Yeah, I meant to look that up. What is that about?"
And I felt like the pit fall out of my stomach. I was like, oh, well, and actually it wasn't that bad because I knew that there was something about it that I was not going to get until the very end. And I thought, this is the brilliance of a good twist, I was fully satisfied because I thought that big reveal was the constant tension between, okay, what is the twist? Not what is the twist going to be, but. The beginning reminded me so much of everything we loved about Utopia, right? Do you remember that opening scene of Utopia where they put the gas on and it's just haunting and terrifying? I felt that and I was instantly all in. Then it felt like we're doing some kind of 10 Cloverfield Lane thing. And then you get the fact like, oh, Split. But he injects just enough weirdness in the way the girls talk to each other that it kind of, and the disjointedness when it suddenly jumps to an old lady doing a Skype conference about split personalities giving you power or something, that it put me on guard. And as stuff got weirder and weirder, it just did a brilliant job of sowing those seeds of like, well, this can't be what's actually happening. This has to be seen through the mind of somebody damaged. And once he actually develops superpowers and summons the 24th personality or whatever, and you are thinking, okay, this can't be real. This is all in her mind. It's too on the nose that she's picking up the same weapon a second right. time. This has to be happening in her mind. She has to be the 24th personality. This is all in her. And then a genuine twist was, no, up yours. All of this is actually happening. This guy has superpowers thanks to split personalities, and she really is scarred and damaged, and he's going to leave her alone. And then I was like, wow, that was really satisfying. I never saw that coming, that all of this was flatly real, exactly as it was presented, which just made that end moment with the panning over and David Dunn there. And I thought it was a bit on the nose for him to say they call him Mr. Glass, but I think that was necessary because if you're not going to tell anyone it's a sequel to Unbreakable, you better beat them over the head with every. You better show Bruce Willis wearing a work shirt that says Dunn on it to remind you and use the exact same line from the end of Unbreakable to sell this point. And they did all of that. And it was great. I loved it. Loved it.
Well, and the other thing that's brilliant about this, and again, I'm saying this based on what you've told me, but I see it in Split, is that you now have two movies that are superhero movies.
Yes.
But the first one is setting up a superhero, and the second one is setting up a villain, but neither one of them feel like superhero movies.
I hope I'm not going to Do you think you could carve out time to watch Unbreakable to give your impression of watching?
I intend to. I 100% intend to.
Because it would be like it's a shame you didn't get the surprise of a sequel to Unbreakable. But I would be fascinated to hear about what it's like to watch a Split prequel. Now that you know, and I did spoil full disclosure. I did spoil the fact that the Amtrak train that he gets on, is a reference to his lost father that was lost on the same train that we see at the beginning of Unbreakable. But hot damn, would I love to hear your take on it?
Yeah, no, I actually watched the trailer for Unbreakable this weekend, but I just couldn't carve out the time to watch it. So I will promise to do that at some point. I'm not sure exactly when I'll be able to get to it, but I just want to do that anyway. I want to watch it through those eyes, and I want to watch it soon before Split has faded too far, because like you said, I was kept guessing all the way to the end, and I had exactly that same situation where I'm like, oh, it's the same gun from her flashback. That's why we've been told the flashback. That's something else. And then the twist being, no, this is what happened. This is all real. She's not imagining it. And then no, they could get away with that partly because then they have the Dunn twist for people who felt like, oh, I really wanted something else, and that's the thing that satisfies it.
Yeah. Wow. What a bold decision. Oh, and real quick, who put those images together of the Split poster and the Unbreakable poster, where it's like they're both the same poster?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. They're both shattered glass in almost in almost a matching pattern, like side by side. You look and it's like. Here, take a look at this and tell
me.
They
have the same motif.
Sure. That's what I'm saying. Like, well, yeah, I don't know. There's Unbreakable and Split. Like,
these angles don't.
No. I'm not saying they're two halves of the same thing.
Sure. Samuel Jackson is not in the Split poster.
I am saying sure. That they laid in front of us a significant clue that made sense in the revelation. They put two and two in front of us and convinced us it was five, and then they revealed the truth four, and that's my favorite magic trick of all.
I love that one too. All right. Shall we then move on to Justified, episode 6 of season 5? And my favorite moment in this episode, you mentioned earlier because you had just watched it when I called you, is that we have a cell phone call, which happens all the time in these shows, right? Hey, I'm over here. Yeah, okay. Well, here's the orders, and they can't get reception. They can't hear each other, and what? So there's miscommunication because his signal isn't very good up there in the holler.
Yeah, well, which you would expect in the holler, because I've done shows in those areas, yeah. And you never have signal. And so it was great to see that.
He said something about shoes, I think. I don't know.
And in meanwhile, it's supposed to be clearly this big face-off between Dewey Crow and Boyd Crowder. Several elements we got here on this one. I'm going to actually open up the episode to make sure I scrub through it. But let me ask you this. These came out, actually, I don't know when. 2014. Did these come out?
Well, this one's Kill the Messenger came out February 11th, 2014. So almost 3 years to the day.
Was this was before or after the Orange is the New Black?
It was around the same time. Yeah. Really? And they've got that same look when Ava goes into Gen Pop, don't they? I thought about the same thing. And one of the actors is a Orange is the New Black actor as well.
It is a very different experience watching that scene. I bet that scene had a lot more teeth in a pre-dramedy Orange is the New Black world where it's just like, oh, yeah, they're all getting along and all that stuff.
Yeah, Orange is the New Black came out in 2013, July 11th, 2013. So first season was out when this episode of Justified aired, and some people had watched it. Right. It was fairly popular, but probably not everybody watching Justified had seen it.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I'll tell you this much. It was a good twist to see that she was not protected and to have the new bad guy being, you know, the true racist or whatever. I'll tell you what, man, a few random thoughts. Number one, why is it whenever chicks cut their hair off on TV shows, they cut like 3 inches of their hair and it's supposed to be the most dramatic thing in the world, you know? Like,
I don't know, man.
Just cut it all off. Go bald.
Cutting it off is hard. That's what that's telling you.
Yeah, sure. Also, loved. Also, Raylan's not the star of the show at this point. To me, he's a robot, and even though it begins with Art punching him in the eye over what seems to me a fairly insignificant, inconvenient transgression on his part to allow actual justice to be dispensed.
I think if you're a marshal, that's pretty bad. Like you were an accessory to murder.
That's fine. But they certainly have not made us, the audience, feel like that was a terrible, bad thing. Not in the way that the Shield made us feel like Vic Mackey's activities were super bad in that moment.
Okay. That's just a difference of opinion. Cause I definitely am getting the fumes off of Art about this, built on top of the money problem earlier. Art's getting tired of covering for Raylan.
Yeah. But also Art's on his way out. And also Raylan did the right thing. And also, why did they change?
Raylan did not do the right thing.
Wait, no, he
like,
did.
Like he, maybe he achieved the right ends, but the means justified the ends, which is not the Marshall way.
Okay. But explain to me how we go.
Sorry, the ends justified the means. I got that backwards.
Explain to me how we went from the end of last episode where he clearly walks back into the office, closes the door, and says, I could tell you the truth.
Yeah.
And then I guess he walks out. The two agree to meet later. At some point, Art tells Raylan what bar he's drinking at. And
yeah, I was a little unclear on why they were both at the bar.
So that it he sort could of punch was either so,
it was like Raylan just wandered in there by accident. Hey, Art, or they set it up, at which point I guess Art just got tired. Like, I got nothing to say. I'm just going to punch you in the face then. Like that part was a little weird too, but this could threaten Art's retirement. I mean, he has basically put Art in a situation where if Raylan gets discovered in either of the things we know about, and there may be others that Art knows about that we don't as viewers, Art could lose his job and his retirement, and he's 6 months away.
Okay. If that is the angle that we should care about, probably, you know, you could have dropped a few more hints about how excited he was about retirement so that I'd feel like...
They've dropped tons of hints. I don't know what you're talking about. No, no, it's like mentioned every episode.
They dropped hints that he is retiring, but I always felt like this is somebody who loves his work who's now being played off the stage.
Well, yeah, but I don't need to be told that when someone's near retirement, they don't want it threatened. I feel like that's fine. It would be putting it too on the nose to have him every episode going, I'm so excited about my retirement. I almost felt like it was too much for them to keep bringing it up.
Yeah. All right. Fair enough. Okay. I could see that. But at this point, I don't know. I find myself the least I've been committed to Raylan since I really felt like I came to know him. The least I've been committed to Art since I came to know him. The most I've been invested in Boyd Crowder by a lot. This is a guy who has almost nothing. And I hated the Crows this entire episode until suddenly they were foot soldiers of Boyd and they were okay in my book. I hated, they made a very good job of making me individually hate each one for incompetence and arrogance and doing it. And instead Boyd just says, ain't a lot of money in shutting you down. How would you guys like to work something out? And blah.
Yeah, the Crows are all in his face, right? What are you going to do about it? I don't know. Hire you?
Yes. Yes. It was great.
Figure this out. Let's make it happen. And then, and then shuts down the person who double-crossed him, right?
Yep.
Like, that was almost too clear-cut. I'm like, really? You go to a guy and you pay him to protect Ava, and then he doesn't expect you to come back at him in any way? Like, that seems surprising, but it was worth it to get the Crowder team up.
By the way, that twist is totally foreshadowed just 20 minutes earlier when we have the moment that while kidnapped, Carl, is that his name? Carl's sitting there covered in duct tape and bloodied bruises from the younger of the Crow brothers. And Raylan happens upon him. And then without batting an eye, realizing the only way he gets out of this without a fight happening that he doesn't get to deal with, he says, nope. We were having sex. It's our thing. We have mutual interests.
Guess we should have agreed on a safe word. Yep. Sorry.
That was and then meanwhile, like Raylan instantly sees the wisdom of what's happening, and then phrases it, and then states it flatly, and then Carl's just like, "Hey man, I ain't a fortune teller. I don't know what the future holds." But what say you cut me out? We call it a day.
Well, and every party, like, it's the only solution, right? Is every party gets to walk away at that point. I mean, Raylan would have rather arrested them. I get that. But he also didn't want to necessarily get in a shootout with them. And so this is it's such a beautiful piece of negotiation where it's like, you're not going to dispute me because then you have to deal with Raylan.
Yeah.
You'd rather let me go than deal with Raylan. And Raylan's not going to dispute me because he can't. Like, if we both agree, then he's got nothing to talk about because we'll both just say, well, of course I was tied up. It was consensual, et cetera, et cetera. So it's such an elegant way to cut through that knot. And you're absolutely right. I hadn't even thought about the fact that it's a micro version of what Boyd does later.
Exactly. Like it's clear that they're on the same page and that Carl's the ones to watch. He's the new Wynn Duffy, as far as I'm concerned. Oh, speaking of which, we do get a quick setup scene of a new vector on the Wynn Duffy side of things. I'm not entirely sure what all of it means, but it's clear that they're working on a partnership.
Well, we're setting up pieces for the Johnny exchange, right?
Yeah.
And that's also a nice, there's a lot of elegant negotiating happens in this, and we meet the Mexicans who are going to be the new suppliers. And of course, that's a cool thing that we've got a Korean who's Mexican, and that's a little part of this whole racial tension and explanation that happens in Harlan. But the main thing is they're going to have to go down and meet to do the pickup. And so when Boyd calls the guy who got double crossed, who was going to hand over Johnny, and then his own people turned against him, he has to figure out a way to tell Boyd without getting discovered that he's telling Boyd that he's been double-crossed. And so he comes up with that ingenious, like, remember that last time we did a business deal? It'll go just as smooth as that. And of course, that was the time that Boyd double-crossed him and stole all his pot.
Well, and I think he specifically says, make sure it goes just as smooth as that. So it ascribed agency and intention on that as well. By the way, Perfect Face for Radio in the chat says, is Boyd the Hundred Eyes of Justified? Oh, no. He's the Genghis Khan of Justified. He is the real star of the show. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, maybe the Carl guy is the Hundred Eyes.
Yeah, yeah. Point. No, Carl is fascinating. Every scene he's been in, I think, has been really, really strong. Enjoying it a lot. I liked how powerful that opening scene was of the open intimidation of the caseworker. And yes, she's a flawed character. She's, you know, dirty in that she's planting drugs on people to get the kids. You know, she uses the ends to justify the means. She's also smoking dope and drinking booze and all that stuff. But you see some unfair tactics and some crude thug-like behavior on the Crow Clan's part that really made me hate them all the way up until they became under Boyd's control.
Well, and another thing that I don't think we've talked about enough is Erica Dizell's character, Rachel, Agent Brooks. She has slowly been taken over as Raylan's best friend. And when they volunteer to go count bullets because Raylan really just wants to ditch, she goes with him and doesn't. He hits the basement button. She's like, why'd you hit the basement button? She's like, because you're going to go count bullets. He's like, no, I'm not. I'm going with you. And she doesn't just go with him to keep an eye on him. She goes to back him up.
Yeah. That was a nice twist. And I wonder, forgive me for saying, what's it mean when somebody suspects somebody's, got a second life and then they finally come clean and there's no conflict between the two and they're on the same team?
You trying to play matchmaker here, Brian?
No, I'm trying to say noble sacrifice upcoming in five.
Yes. No, absolutely. It could be. I'm not even going to look to see if Erica Tazell is still in the cast for season six.
Who knows? Yeah, who knows? We'll see.
Yeah. Okay. So on that vein of like, we're setting up things. I can't remember the Crow. Is it Daryl, the one who shot the guy from Florida?
Danny? Is that the one?
Or is it Danny?
Danny and Daryl. Let's see.
And the one who tells the young one to not talk about the fact that he shot.
The truly evil thug. Yeah, yeah. That's the one.
He's the one that did the woofing and ran poor man's Ava off the road.
Yep.
I feel like we've really been setting him up for some kind of reckoning. Like,
No. To be honest, I feel like it's Jaime Lannister. We hate him so much that he's the one who's going to be spared. And it's this older, more reasonable brother.
Is it Jaime or is it Jaime's son?
Joffrey. Yeah. No.
I think it's Joffrey.
Yeah.
Personally.
Could be.
It's Danny. You're right. Danny Crow and Kendall is the kid.
I feel like I just hate him so much that they're going to guarantee to shove him in my face and that we're going to lose the reasonable one who is a bully but knows how to make it work. But anyway.
All right. Well, either way, whatever fate they meet will be justified.
No, you did. No. No points on that one.
See you next week.
It's wedged in.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.